A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's in a Connecticut basement this week. Cobwebs, old boxes, decades of debris. He knows radon's a concern in the region, but figures a few hours of exposure isn't what keeps you up at night. What he actually wants to know is, how do you spot materials that might contain asbestos when you're just doing occasional afternoon-long cleanups? And then he asks something I hadn't seen anyone compare head-to-head. How does that short-term asbestos risk actually stack up against the radon risk everyone in Connecticut talks about?
And this is a better question than most of what you find online. Because the internet's asbestos advice splits into two camps. Everything will kill you, and it's basically nothing. Neither one helps someone holding a broom in a basement built in 1958. You're either supposed to call a hazmat team because you glanced at a floor tile, or you're supposed to just not worry about it and get back to sweeping. There's no middle ground.
Which is exactly the middle ground Daniel's standing in. He's not renovating, he's not demolishing, he's just moving boxes and clearing cobwebs for a few hours on a Saturday. He needs the practical middle.
So we're going to give you the visual cheat sheet the EPA doesn't exactly hand out at the hardware store. And then we're going to do something weird, compare two very different hazards that both live in basements.
And I should say up front, none of this is a substitute for professional testing. If you're planning a renovation, you need a certified inspector. But if you're just trying to figure out whether you can safely spend an afternoon in Grandma's basement, this is the episode for you.
Let's start with what's actually down there. Asbestos is banned in new construction. The EPA's finally tightening the rules. The phase-out's been in the works for a few years now, but it's still in millions of homes built before 1980. Connecticut's housing stock is old. Median home age is around 60 years. That means pre-banned materials are everywhere, and the EPA's list of common asbestos-containing products runs something like 20-plus categories. Most people only know about insulation. The reality is much weirder.
Weirder how?
Floor tiles. That's the one people walk past every day and never think about. If you're in a pre-1980 basement and you see 9x9-inch square tiles, those are almost always asbestos-containing. The size is the giveaway. 9x9 was the standard for asphalt, asbestos, and vinyl, asbestos tiles. 12x12 tiles are more ambiguous. Some contain asbestos, some don't. But the 9x9 rule is about as close to certainty as you get without a lab.
So the tile tells you by its dimensions. That's oddly satisfying, like a secret code built into the floor.
It really is. And the reason it works is that 9x9 was the industry standard for decades. Manufacturers didn't make that size in non-asbestos formulations until much later. So when you see that specific square, you're looking at a manufacturing decision from an era when asbestos was considered a miracle additive. Fireproof, durable, cheap. They put it in everything.
And it's not just the tile itself.
Right. And it's not just the tile, the mastic underneath, the black adhesive that glues it down, that often contains asbestos too. So if you're moving boxes across an old tile floor and the tiles are intact, you're fine. But if you see one that's cracked, crumbling, or if someone already pulled a few up and left the black adhesive exposed, that's where you stop and leave it alone. The black mastic is actually one of the nastier forms because it's already in a degraded state once it's exposed. It's been sitting under a tile for 60 years and now suddenly it's in contact with air and foot traffic.
And that's the kind of thing someone might not even register as a hazard. They'd see exposed glue and think it's just old adhesive.
It doesn't look dangerous. It looks like dried out construction adhesive. But that black cutback adhesive, as it's called, was often 40 to 50% asbestos by weight. You don't want to be sweeping over that.
What about the stuff people actually recognize as insulation?
Two big ones in basements. First, pipe insulation. The classic corrugated cardboard look on steam pipes and hot water lines. It's actually a calcium silicate or magnesia-based wrap, and in pre-1980 homes it frequently contains asbestos. The white cloth tape wrapping pipe joints is another tell. If it looks like someone wrapped the pipes in lumpy papier-mâché and then painted it white, assume it's asbestos.
And the second one?
Vermiculite insulation in attics. But here's the thing. Attics and basements connect. If you're cleaning the basement and there's vermiculite that's filtered down through wall cavities or been tracked around, you want to know what it looks like. Small gray-brown pebbles, kind of accordion-shaped if you look close. They pop when you squeeze them. The Zonalite brand from Libby, Montana. That's the one that contaminated roughly 70% of all vermiculite sold in the U.S. between 1919 and 1990 with tremolite asbestos. The EPA's own estimate. If you see pebbly insulation anywhere in an older house, treat it as hazardous.
Pop when you squeeze them.
Yeah, which is exactly the kind of thing a curious person does before they know what they're looking at. You see weird pebbles in the corner, you pick one up, you squeeze it, it goes pop, and you think, huh, that's interesting. Meanwhile, you've just crushed a piece of asbestos containing vermiculite between your fingers.
So don't squeeze the pebbles.
Don't squeeze the pebbles. And don't sweep them. Never sweep or vacuum suspected asbestos debris that aerosolizes fibers. Damp wipe or use a HEPA vacuum if you must clean. But honestly, for Daniel's situation, the better move is just not disturbing it. If you see a pile of weird gray pebbles in the corner of the basement, walk around them. They're not hurting anyone sitting there.
What else is hiding in plain sight?
Textured ceiling popcorn. That's pre-1978. Sheetrock joint compound, pre-1977. Transite siding. That's cement asbestos board that looks like gray shingles, but is harder and more brittle than modern fiber cement. Old furnace gaskets and door ropes. The EPA's product list even includes automotive brake pads, but that's less relevant for basement cleaning.
Wait, joint compound? Like the stuff used to tape drywall seams?
Yeah, and this one catches people off guard because joint compound looks like nothing. It's just smooth white mud on a wall seam. But pre-1977 compound often contained asbestos as a binder and texturizer. If you're in an old basement with exposed drywall seams and someone decides to sand a rough patch, that's a problem. The asbestos in joint compound is friable once you start sanding it.
So even a small repair job can turn into an exposure event if you don't know what you're looking at.
And that's the thing. Most people wouldn't think twice about sanding a bumpy wall seam. It's just drywall mud. But in an old house, that mud might be 5% asbestos.
So you've got floor tiles, pipe wrap, ceiling texture, joint compound, siding, gaskets. And the through line for Daniel is...
The through line is the EPA's distinction between friable and non-friable. Friable means you can crumble it by hand. It releases fibers easily. Pipe insulation that's deteriorating, that's friable. Non-friable means the asbestos is bound in a matrix, like a floor tile or cement board, and it only releases fibers when you saw, sand, or demolish it. For someone just moving boxes and sweeping, the risk profile is completely different from a renovation crew.
So the visual guide is really a triage system. Some things you can work around. Some things you stop and leave alone.
If it's intact and you're not sanding, cutting, or demolishing it, the risk is minimal. The EPA explicitly states that intact, undamaged asbestos-containing materials don't pose a health risk. The danger comes from disturbance. Which is why Daniel's just moving boxes scenario is fundamentally different from a renovation. Practical rule of thumb, if you see crumbling, peeling, or powdery material around any of these items, stop. If it's smooth and intact, you can work around it.
That's the visual guide. But here's where it gets interesting. How does that risk compare to the other invisible thing in Connecticut basements?
Right, so let's talk about the risk math first, then we'll get to radon.
Because Daniel's real question isn't just, what does asbestos look like? It's, should I actually be worried about an afternoon down there?
And the short answer is, probably not, but let's unpack why. The mesothelioma dose response curve isn't linear. It's heavily weighted toward cumulative high concentration exposures over years. The classic cases are shipyard workers, insulation installers, people who spent decades in clouds of the stuff. For someone doing occasional basement cleaning with intact materials, the risk is orders of magnitude lower.
Orders of magnitude. That's not a bit lower. That's a completely different category.
It is. And there's a useful comparison here, the NIOSH follow-up on World Trade Center first responders. These were people with intense, short-term exposure. Months of high-concentration dust that contained asbestos, among other things. 20-plus years later, they haven't shown elevated mesothelioma rates. Researchers still watch for it, The latency period is 20 to 50 years, so it could still emerge, but the fact that it hasn't spiked yet tells you something about how the dose response works.
Wait, months of breathing, ground zero dust, and no mesothelioma spike 20 years out?
That's what the data shows so far. And that was a genuinely intense exposure, not an afternoon of moving boxes in a basement with intact floor tiles. So the risk for Daniel's scenario is, it's not zero, nothing's zero. But it's in the range of things you manage with knowledge rather than things you lose sleep over.
But there's a catch.
There's always a catch. The latency period. Asbestos-related disease takes 20 to 50 years to show up. A single high-concentration exposure event, like sanding an old floor tile without protection, can theoretically cause disease. The epidemiological evidence for single-event causation is weak, but it's not impossible. The real risk is cumulative. If you do this kind of cleaning every few years across multiple properties, the exposures add up. It's not the one afternoon. It's the pattern.
So Daniel's fine for this weekend, but if he makes a habit of cleaning out old basements without knowing what he's looking at, the math shifts.
Right. And that's why the visual guide matters. It's not about fear. It's about knowing what not to touch.
Okay. Radon. Daniel mentioned it, and Connecticut's got a reputation.
Connecticut has some of the highest average indoor radon levels in the U.S. The EPA's Zone 1 map, that's the highest risk zone, predicted average indoor levels above 4 picocuries per liter covers most of the state. Average indoor levels in some counties exceed 5. Radon causes about 21,000 lung cancer deaths per year in the U.S., second only to smoking.
21,000? That's a real number.
It's a real number. But here's the key difference. Radon risk is cumulative over a lifetime of exposure. It's a continuous, invisible hazard that builds up in sealed basements over years. You breathe it in, the decay products irradiate your lung tissue, and over decades that damage accumulates into cancer risk. An afternoon in a high radon basement isn't the concern. Living in it for 20 years is.
So for Daniel's situation, a few hours here and there, the asbestos risk from disturbing old pipe insulation or crumbling floor tiles is probably higher than the radon risk from breathing basement air.
And the mechanism is completely different. Asbestos is a particulate hazard. It only matters when you disturb it. Radon is a continuous gas hazard. It matters when you live in it. For a single afternoon of cleaning, the thing you might kick up into the air is more relevant than the thing that's been quietly accumulating for decades.
Which means the practical takeaway flips depending on who you are. If Daniel's just helping out on weekends, he should be more worried about not sanding old floor tiles than about radon. But if he ever moves into that house full time, he should test for radon immediately.
And testing is cheap. You can get a radon test kit for 20 or 30 bucks. Leave it in the basement for a few days, send it to a lab, and you'll know. If it's above 4 picocuries per liter, the EPA recommends mitigation, which is basically a fan and a pipe that vents the gas from under the foundation. It's not complicated, it's just, most people don't do it because radon is invisible and odorless.
Which gets to something I think is worth naming. The psychology of invisible hazards.
Say more.
People worry more about visible threats. Cobwebs, dust, old insulation you can see. Radon is colorless and odorless. It doesn't trigger the same alarm. For a long-term resident, that's exactly backwards. Radon is the thing silently accumulating in your lungs while you worry about the pipe wrap you never touch. But for a short-term visitor like Daniel, the intuition is actually correct. The thing you can see and might disturb is the thing to pay attention to. The invisible gas that takes decades to do damage doesn't matter for an afternoon.
The psychology lines up with the actual risk in this specific scenario, but for completely the wrong reasons. Daniel's right to focus on asbestos, but not because visible threats are inherently more dangerous. He's right, because the exposure timescale makes asbestos the more relevant hazard for a short visit.
So the episode validates his intuition, while also explaining why it works, and when it wouldn't.
Right. If he were moving into that basement, we'd flip the whole conversation. Radon first, asbestos second. But for the afternoon helper, it's know what not to touch, don't create dust, and don't worry about the air you're breathing.
There's one more thing I want to pull on. The EPA's asbestos ban is finally being tightened. The phase-out's been in progress, but millions of homes still contain legacy materials. We're managing a hazard that's already built into the infrastructure. How do you handle that at scale?
You don't really. The EPA's current guidance is written for professionals, abatement contractors, home inspectors, people with training and equipment. There's a gap for the afternoon helper demographic. The person who's not renovating, not demolishing, just cleaning out a relative's basement and wants to know what to leave alone. The visual guide we just walked through. 9x9 tiles, corrugated pipe wrap, vermiculite pebbles. That's not formally taught anywhere for non-professionals.
It's locked in industrial hygiene manuals.
Which nobody reads for fun, as you've pointed out before.
I did say that. And I stand by it. I've tried. They're not page-turners.
The thing is, as more old homes get renovated by DIYers and occasional cleaners, and Connecticut's got no shortage of old homes, the need for accessible identification resources grows. The EPA's website has the information, but it's not packaged for someone who's just trying to figure out whether they can sweep this floor or not. You have to click through 6 pages and 3 PDFs to piece together what we just said in 10 minutes.
What's the one-sentence rule for Daniel?
If it looks old and crumbly, treat it like asbestos and don't touch it. If it looks intact, treat it like asbestos, but you can work around it. The visual guide is for knowing what to avoid, not for ruling things out.
Because you can't actually rule things out by looking.
No, and that's the part most people get wrong. Visual clues are suggestive, not diagnostic. The only way to confirm asbestos is polarized light microscopy. You send a sample to a lab. But for Daniel's situation, you don't need confirmation. You just need to know what not to sand, saw, or sweep.
Which brings us to
1993. I spent a summer in college working for an environmental testing company out of Hartford. We'd go into these Victorian houses all over New England and take core samples of floor tiles and pipe wrap. The thing nobody tells you about asbestos testing is that the testing itself is more dangerous than just leaving it alone. We had to wear full Tyvek suits and respirators just to take a thumbnail-sized sample. You're scraping material loose to prove it's hazardous, and in the process, you're creating the exact exposure you're trying to prevent.
You're telling me the testing is worse than the material?
For a single sample, no. But we were taking 50 samples a day. The real irony is that the people who get the highest cumulative exposure are the ones trying to identify and remove the stuff, not the homeowners who just leave it alone. I knew guys who'd been doing it for years. They were careful, but careful only goes so far when your job is to disturb asbestos for 8 hours a day.
The visual guide we just spent 10 minutes on?
It's useful for knowing what to avoid. It's useless for ruling things out. I've seen 12x12 tiles from 1975 that tested positive and 9x9 tiles from 1960 that were just final. The 9x9 rule is a good heuristic, but it's not a law of nature. The only way to know is the microscope. But here's the thing, for Daniel's situation, it doesn't matter. If it looks old and crumbly, treat it like asbestos. If it looks intact, treat it like asbestos, but don't touch it. You don't need a lab report to decide not to sand a floor tile.
That's actually a sharper version of what I was trying to say. The visual guide is a triage tool, not a diagnostic tool.
Right. And the triage is, leave it alone. That's the answer, almost every time. The EPA says intact materials don't pose a health risk, so why would you pay someone to come disturb them? Half the abatement projects I saw were homeowners who got scared by a home inspection and paid thousands of dollars to create a hazard that didn't exist before.
They removed intact asbestos and made it friable in the process.
Or they paid someone else to. Same result. The stuff was fine in the wall. Now it's in the air. I remember one job where a homeowner had paid $6,000 to have perfectly intact pipe insulation removed from a basement. The abatement crew did everything right. Containment, negative air pressure, the works. But you're still taking something that was sealed and stable and turning it into a removal project. There's no way to do that with zero fiber release. The pre-abatement air sample came back clean. The post-abatement sample took 3 rounds of recleaning to pass. They literally made the air worse by removing the hazard.
The real advice for Daniel is, if you see something that looks like it might be asbestos and it's not crumbling, just keep moving boxes.
Keep moving boxes. Don't sand anything. Don't drill anything. If you need to clean, damp, wipe. And if you find something that's already falling apart, stop and call someone who knows what they're doing. But for an afternoon of clearing cobwebs in a basement with intact materials, the drive to Connecticut is probably more dangerous than the basement.
That's a sentence that'll stick with me.
I had a coworker who used to say, the most hazardous thing in any old house is the stairs. He wasn't wrong.
The stairs?
People fall downstairs. Asbestos just sits there. It's not looking for you. It's not off-gassing. It's not accumulating in your lungs while you sleep. It's a rock. It stays where you leave it. The only way it becomes a problem is if you do something to it.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the hazard isn't the material. It's the disturbance. Asbestos in an old house is like a sleeping dog. Walk past it, you're fine. Poke it with a stick, you might regret it.
The second thing is that radon and asbestos aren't even playing the same sport. One's a marathon, one's a sprint. Daniel's running a sprint, and he's right to focus on what he might kick up rather than what's been quietly accumulating for decades.
The infrastructure question sticks with me, though. Millions of homes with legacy asbestos, and the guidance for the person just trying to help out on a Saturday is scattered across 20 EBA pages, written for contractors. There's a gap there.
There is. And as more of these homes change hands and get cleaned out by family members rather than professionals, that gap matters more. Maybe that's the open question. How do you do public health communication for a hazard that's already built into the walls when the audience isn't the people who installed it, but the people who inherited it?
Because the people who installed it knew what it was. Or at least the manufacturers did. The people inheriting it often have no idea they're even standing next to it.
That's the generational problem. We built a country full of asbestos and then spent 50 years not teaching anyone how to recognize it. Now the houses are changing hands and the knowledge isn't transferring with the deed.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently spent a summer in a Tyvek suit and has opinions about stairs.
If you want more episodes like this one, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.